Welcome to Lost and Starting Over with Linda Ballesteros. Death, sickness, unemployment, sadness, depression, divorce. Do you feel like you're alone in any of this? Well, you're not. Together we can find a way out. Get ready for Lost and Starting Over, a show on the Tough Talk Radio Network. Now here's your host, Linda Ballesteros.
Hey folks, welcome to Lost and Starting Over. This is Linda Ballesteros. I'm your host today, and I want to, first of all, thank you for being with me today. I always say that time is that one commodity that you can't get back, and I'm always honored when someone spends some time with me. You know, there's that the different love languages, and I would have to say that mine is probably time, because I'm always honored to spend some time with someone. If people take time out of their busy day to have even a cup of coffee with you, be grateful. Let them know that you appreciate that, and I'm sure that they will feel the love, and that's what it's all about. So today we're going to jump right into it. Today our guest is Guy Oliver. Guy is a professional writer of more than 25 years, an avocational blogger. He's a published author and a speaker. He's a father of three, and he lives in Austin with his wife, Heidi, and his best friend. Guy, you'll have to correct me on the pronunciation here. Is it Liesl?
Liesl, that's correct. Oldest of the Von Trapp children, yes.
Very good. Well, thanks for being on the show. I'm really so glad that you're here and share some of your story. And I tell you what, Guy, I just absolutely love following you on social media because you are a crack up. And folks, if you're not following him, you should be. That's Guy Oliver, O-L-I-V-E-R. So be sure to follow him on Facebook because he has some great wisdom out there that he shares with everyone. A Life That Mattered. And that was written about your son, Tim. And
yes,
would you share a little bit about his struggles with addiction and a little bit about why you wrote the book?
Well, I guess starting with why I wrote the book is probably the most appropriate question to answer first. I was kind of a wreck after, I guess I should also offer, the book is about the life of my son. He was in a one car accident about 3.5 years ago, and he didn't survive. He was with his fiance Donna. It was an inexplicable accident. The authorities couldn't explain what happened. His truck left the road at highway speed and struck a tree, and it left a lot of unanswered questions. And so I was not, as you can imagine, I was not in a very good place for a very long time. And I was, because I've been a writer for so long, people kept encouraging me to write about the book as therapy, as catharsis. And I kept looking at the life of my son with his struggles with addiction and some of the other problems that I'll get into a little bit later. And I just kept asking myself the question, what story would I tell? Because as a writer, that's the thing. You always have to have an audience in mind and a sense of the story that you want to tell that audience. I spent some time with a friend. Her name is Charlie Fern, whose father passed 3 days before my son. And he was a decorated Vietnam War veteran who mentored an ambassador and an astronaut and was a West Point graduate. And, you know, my son was an addict and a convicted felon and didn't have a high school education. But when we started talking about the way that their lives were at the end of their lives, I didn't really see a significant difference that this person, that Charlie's dad, who by society standards was a great man, his life came to an end because he suffered from PTSD that wasn't addressed by the government or by anybody else. He just didn't have the resources to address it. And my son suffered from PTSD from his time in prison. And I began to see the parallels. And what came to mind was that it doesn't matter what your station in life is when you pass. All of the accomplishments that we like to hang a weight on and say this is great and this is small, I realized that they both mattered, and that their accomplishments had less to do with, you know, victories in combat getting ribbons and medals. It had less to do with those kinds of great accomplishments and more to who they were to the people in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so to the question of why I started writing this book, I was suddenly inspired to bring forward the message that every life actually does matter, even if from the outside looking in, you see somebody who is worthless. To so many others, that person is worthwhile. And I looked back on who Tim actually was, and I wanted to tell that story, and I wanted to help others who were struggling with the loss of a loved one, whether it's to addiction, to incarceration, or to loss of life.
Mm-hmm. You know, Guy, I have to tell you, I lost a brother years ago, I think it was in 95, to AIDS. And there was a stigma that was around that. And I didn't share the reason for his death to just anybody and everything, not because I didn't want them judging me, but I didn't want them judging him. Because it was a very difficult, difficult death to watch him go through that, and then to have someone judge and say, "Well, he caused it." So, did you have some of those feelings as well? That how do you allow yourself to be vulnerable by sharing when you're not sure that the person on the other side will be gentle and receive it?
Well, the part of the catharsis of, and there wasn't much in the beginning, the writing this book, I wrote it in 1,200 word segments that I gave away on my blog. And initially there was no catharsis, but part of the eventual catharsis that happened in writing this book was the courage to say to somebody, to be able figuratively look someone in the eye as the writer and say to the reader, you know, there shouldn't be a shame associated with this.
Right.
In the chapter where I talk about his addiction, when he was in the depths of it, I go to great lengths to explain that what we saw that we found so horrendous in the behavior of the addict was not my son, but it was his addiction. Mm-hmm. And the addict goes through so much shame and guilt that then feeds back into the addiction. Most adults are aware of the addiction cycle and what that's about. But taking away the shame and shunning the guilt, in my opinion, was a necessary exercise as social commentary that I wanted to offer people who are dealing with family members who are addicted. And that what you're looking at when you see that hideous behavior, I refer to it as a mask. It's something that hides who the person really is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really looking at the person, and to try to remember that beautiful person mm-hmm. that you knew when he's not under the influence of meth or heroin or some other drug that just completely takes over your mind and kills your soul.
Yeah, and it definitely tears families apart. So did you see that there had to be some healing with your daughters as well, finding out that after his death, and is there a sense of relief for the family? How did you go through that healing process with your daughters?
Well, my daughters were, I guess, for lack of a better term, sociologically at opposite ends of the spectrum with regard to their relationship with Tim. My youngest daughter, Ashley, was, she washed her hands of him. And after he got out of prison, she scolded me a couple of times for carrying on a relationship with him, which was, for me, a reuniting, because mm-hmm. we had been estranged before he went to prison. And so I was trying to redevelop this relationship with him, but she really wanted nothing to do with him. My older daughter, Rachel, was very, very close to him. And she admitted to me, and I write about this in the book, that it was so painful for her to deal with this situation that she really didn't, at least not in the beginning. She threw herself into taking care of her mother because he was very, very close to her. And so she was very concerned about how my ex-wife was coping with this terrible thing. And so I didn't really have the opportunity to spend a lot of time healing with my daughters for their own reasons. And that speaks to another thing that we all say it and we all know it intellectually, or I should say cerebrally, but I really began to embrace it with my heart that the way that people deal with grief is different for, I mean this, for every individual. It's mm-hmm. what you do to overcome that is different. And I really experienced the concept of not judging somebody else for how they deal their feeling. And I just tried to make myself available to them and not show them very much of my grief, because I was afraid mm-hmm. that they were going to get trapped into a situation where they were caring for me in the way that I should have been caring for them, or at least that's the way I felt at the time.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, grief is such an interesting emotion. You know, I've lost both of my parents. Like I mentioned, I lost my brother and recently lost my husband. And each time that grief is different. The way I approached grief is very different. I'm pretty much the same person, but each time, because of my relationship with each of my parents, with my brother, with my husband, it's very different. So like you said, that was one of the reasons that I started this radio show, is to right. allow people talk about how they did work through the grief. You know, the loss is the loss, and I'm certainly not minimizing that. But you know, once we have experienced the loss, life is no longer the same from that moment on. And we have to find out what that new normal is. So, Guy, how did you work through that to find your new normal? It's been several years now. Do you still find yourself having those moments?
Oh, I absolutely do. And I think the hardest thing to come to grips with is that you, in a loss, well, losing a child, for one thing, is a it's an out of order death. So we're genetically predispositioned to bury our parents and in some way cope with the loss of a peer, like a sibling or a friend. But there is no equivalent to burying a child. And so one of the things that I had to come to terms with, and it took me about 2.5 years to really embrace, is that you will have those moments and there's no getting around them. And what I have started doing is I've just started trying to, And like I said, about 2 years plus into it, I really began to just embrace, you know, just sitting with it, And, you know, I would say it was just night before last, I had one of those moments. And, you know, there's no real prescription for that. The only advice that anyone can give you is understand that if it's a significant loss, you're going to revisit the grief. The grief is going to come back just like waves on a shore. It happens, and there's nothing you can do about it other than understand that these are really, this is the evidence of the love that you shared, the love bond that you shared with that person. If you didn't feel that, it would be because you didn't have that love bond with that person. And in itself is a great uplifting perspective to take from such a difficult situation.
Absolutely. And, you know, Guy, one of the things that I've said to people is the situation that I went through last year, losing my husband, that wasn't on my vision board. So I wasn't prepared for that. You know,
That's
not something that we actually, you know, it's not a goal out there. It's not something that we are preparing ourselves all along. So when it happens, it is a shock. So do you feel that, I mean, you talked about your son, you talked about this gentleman going through PTSD. Do you think that you went through some of that as well after this situation?
Absolutely did. It was never diagnosed. Looking back, the most difficult memories I have were not of even missing my son or of the loss of potential, which was the nature of the grief that I felt. At some point, I'd like to talk a little bit about the different types of grief that people experience in a situation like this. But, you know, what I experienced was the loss of potential because I was I was reuniting with my son. But what really still bothers me to this day were the ways that I didn't cope well. I relied much more. Alcohol has been a big part of my life since I worked at a company called Tivoli. That was just part of the culture there, and it was sort of a peon approach. You know, you sat down at a business meeting, you had a drink. You know, and that was just part of it. But I began to rely so much more on that, and I realized looking back, I was perilously close to following the same path that my son followed in his addiction. Looking back, I remember there were moments when I would just have these outbursts that were so retrospectively embarrassing. And people were very understanding. They were like, well, you lost your kid. That's a big thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to judge you for that. But, those are all symptoms of not coping well, because coping well to me would mean that you have a good cleansing cry. You talk with a friend. You get it out, and if you have to yell a little bit, you do. But it's all embracing. It's the process of embracing it. And what I did was I rejected it. I refer to it as the unwelcome thing, you know, abides without invitation and never abates, you know. It stays there, or it did at the time. And so those are the things that really I sort of regret during that time.
Well, you know, Guy, I think that
Right,
and I think that there are times under stress, I don't think any of us are at our best. So I do believe that we don't always say the right things. We don't always make the right decision. It with myself taking care of Mario, I didn't feel that I showed up as my best every day. And I
Right.
will tell you that there were times when after a really tough day, and I would have a drink, and I'm not a big drinker, and I would have a drink, and I would say to myself, I see now how people going through something like this could certainly turn to alcohol because it would help take the edge off some of those days. So I totally
That's
understand
right.
what you were talking about. Now, you mentioned the different types of loss. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Well, I wrote a little bit about this in my book, and every time I say that, what I'm doing is I'm promoting the value of the content to somebody who might be inclined to read it. This is why the book has value. Depending on your relationship and the station of your life with that person, you will experience. There will be different kinds of triggers. Because I was estranged from my son for the better part of his adult life, we didn't spend holidays together, for example. So I have encountered, amazingly enough, a number of acquaintances and friends who lost children that I didn't know had lost children. And for many of them, triggers of their grief have to do with what's called the empty chair syndrome. So on special days that you had with that person, whether that's a holiday like Thanksgiving or Christmas, or maybe you had some ritual that you practice with that individual, and now you continue to do those things, but you do them without them, and their absence weighs heavy on your heart and your mind. It's
right.
just ever present. I had the luxury of not having that type of grief trigger. At Thanksgiving, I remember my son, but I don't remember him sitting across the table from me. For some people, it may be nothing more than you had a special ritual where you exchanged gifts, and you know, you would give each other. I knew a guy who, on his best friend's birthday, he would give him a dollar, and then his best friend on his birthday would give him back that same dollar, and it was just a thing that they had, you know.
Uh-huh.
And when you lose that person, when that birthday comes up, it's a significant anniversary for you.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the anniversary of actually losing that person, for some people, that's the kind of thing that you have to deal with. And there are a number of other ways that grief can be triggered depending on what your relationship was like with that person. For me, it was the lost potential. We were reconciling, and there were so many moments where we were beginning to feel closer. he and I, until he was age four, had an amazingly close relationship. I was closer to him. He was closer to me than he was to his mother until about age four. He was just my little shadow. And I was beginning to re-experience a lot of his desire to be in my life. And when you have someone like a child who wants to be in your life, there's a natural programming in your DNA that draws you to that person and wants to give that person what they so desperately need. In this case, a son's need to be in his father's life. And I felt like that was taken from me. I felt a sense of injustice, especially given the fact that he had cheated death. I say countless times, maybe you actually could count them, but they happened so often that we sort of lost track of how many times he cheated death. And now in this situation, he didn't. And it was at a moment when we were reconciling and he was finally getting his act together and he was doing all the right things for the first time in a decade. And so it's that lost potential that is underscored by the fact that there was an automobile fire that destroyed everything. And so there was no evidence of my son as he was in life. You know, there was not the opportunity to have an open casket. There was no body to bury. And all of those things conspired to produce this grief trigger, if only. I should have. Why now? Why this time? All of those things speak to the injustice of something that you think is yours and is taken from you.
And, you know, it also goes back to, I think I had mentioned this to you in the green room before we came on air, is that I felt as though, as Mario was dealing with his health challenges, that it was not about me. It was between Mario and his God, and I was just there walking behind carrying the luggage. Because I didn't have a vote in any of it. I didn't have an opportunity to make any changes to the direction that it was going to go. Do you feel that at some point you had to just say it wasn't about you? And even though it was, because it was your son, it really was something more than that.
There was a moment, I would call it an epiphany, where I was interviewing one of his cellmates. He developed a very close personal tie to a man by the name of Trevor Grigsby. And they had a mutual friend in prison named Sam. And one of the reasons why they developed such a close personal bond was because they were in an out-processing facility. And life was very hard in that facility. They actually suspended weekend meals. I have some very unkind things to say about the justice system. But in talking with him and listening to his own personal experience of only knowing Tim 2 or 3 years, that wasn't even that long. Maybe 2 years at the outside. He said some things about Tim and his character that came through even in prison. And then afterward, when they sort of continued to hold each other up and exhort each other to hold each other accountable, that Tim was really the leader. And what I began to realize in this 45-minute conversation with Trevor was that Tim came here to do what he was intended to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not up to me. I said in the book I wrote, who am I to tell God his business? It's not up to me to say how many days on earth my son should have or whether he should outlive me. He came to this plane of existence. You know, no matter what you believe we are as we, you know, walk through life and interact with each other, he came to this plane of existence, I believe, for a reason, accomplished what he needed to accomplish, and all the other things, the fact that he was in the middle of vocational training to become a welder, and he was engaged, and he was thinking about having children, and none of that came to fruition. That doesn't matter. That's peripheral. He was living life. And right. In the living of life, we do all of those things, right? But when he was, I finally came to the belief, and it's a matter of faith, just like my faith in God. I'm not going to tell anybody they have to believe in God. It's faith, right? As a matter of faith, I believe he came here, he did what he was meant to do, and then he left. And almost in sort of a preordained way. And that was the moment where I realized that I could lay this burden down, and mm-hmm. I didn't have to struggle any longer with all the what ifs and the whys that
right.
are
or the
really
guilt
not answerable.
Of, you know, could you have saved him or whatever the scenario was? I had to just say, I played my role in this. I did what I was
right.
supposed to do. And the rest was up to, like I said, Mario and his God. And I didn't have a vote in that. So I tell you
right.
what, Guy, we're going to take a real quick commercial break. And I'd like to come back and talk about the quote that you have in your book about, it's an Edgar Allan Poe quote. And it's
okay.
about addiction. So if you don't mind, we'll take a real quick commercial break and we'll come back with more from Guy Oliver.
Thank you.
So you think you're tough enough for Tough Talk with Tony Gambone? Tony knows how to dish it out. Can you take it? Tony Gambone is a communicator, mentor, and entrepreneur whose tough style and generous spirit quickly garnered recognition in many a competitive arena. Now he's bringing his intelligence and knowledge to you as a hard-hitting radio talk show host and thought leader. Tune in and see for yourself. Tough Talk with Tony Gambone. It's a sure thing. To find out more, go to Tough Talk with Tony Gambone.
Tune in every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. to Tough Talk Christian Radio with Tony Gambone. Tough Talk Christian Radio is for those who want to share and receive expressions of faith that will help you take the next step in your relationship with Christ. Listen in to hear from others about their experiences of faith and the love of Christ. Call in to share your experiences at 347-989-1363. Learn more by going to toughtalkchristianradio.com.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Lawson Starting Over. This is Linda Ballesteros, and my guest today is Guy Oliver. He is the author of the book, A Life That Mattered. Now, Guy, before we go any further, would you mind giving the listeners your contact information? If they're listening and maybe struggling with some of the same things that you're talking about, how could they find out more about you and getting a copy of your book?
Well, I have a blog spot. It's my name, GuyOliverSpeaks.com. You can actually, if you're willing to read it segment by segment, you can read the book for free through my blog entries. Then there's a button that you can click to actually purchase the book. I would say that's the best way to get in touch with me. I'm on Facebook as Guy Oliver, there's a Facebook fan page, Guy Oliver Speaks. It's just Guy Oliver Speaks, and I will be posting material there that includes the link to this this broadcast and other things that are related to this book and other things, you know, that are relevant.
Now, Guy, if there are support groups out there and someone's listening, would you be open to them contacting you about possibly speaking to their group?
Yes. That is an active part of the plan to sell this book. And I hate that word, sell. I can't give it away because it costs money. But the purpose of the book is to minister to others that find themselves in a situation, as I said earlier, a loss of a loved one to addiction, incarceration, or loss of life. It's meant to minister to that individual through commiseration. It's not a guidebook. It doesn't tell you how to cope with dealing with. That's not my business. But my business is to say, you're not alone. And part of that is speaking engagements. So, yes.
Very good. Very good. So, folks, if you have a group, a support group, and you're looking for guest speakers who can relate to those that are in your group, certainly Mr. Oliver would be someone that you would want to reach out to. So, Guy, before the break, we talked about the quote that you had, Edgar Allan Poe's quote in your book. Would you mind sharing a little sharing that quote, and then why did you share that quote?
Well, it's a very long passage that I wouldn't want to read on the air, in part because the language is kind of archaic. Poe can be a little bit weighty for the average reader. And in fact, just between you and me, I think he was a really sick twist. But he had a very fertile imagination, and he thought up some really horrendous things. And one of the things that he thought up was, what if there was this giant whirlpool that had the ability to swallow whole ships? And he describes this thing, the maelstrom, which is a violent whirlpool in a large body of water, and how close to it your ship would be sucked into it, and then it would descend to the bottom where there were rocks, and there was enough velocity that it would tear the ship apart on these rocks. And the thing that struck me about that passage, there were two. The first one is, you don't realize when you are first entrapped in the current. By the time you realize there is a current that's drawing you toward this vortex, it's too late. There's no escaping it. And in fact, one of the things my dad told me once, and I actually used this, I was in Schlitterbahn, I got caught in a whirlpool. My dad said, swim with it. At the bottom, there's not much pressure, and you can swim under the water and swim away. And I actually did that. But in a case like this, in this work of fiction, there's no escaping it. And the end is certain. And so the story really revolves around the experience of these men who realize their fate and there's no escape. And because it's deep water, it takes a long time for them to reach the bottom, and they go insane. To me, that was the perfect metaphor for addiction. I mention sirens because that's another fable, a myth of, you know, men on the open sea. They hear the calling of a siren and they're drawn to it, but they're cast upon the rocks, and in the drawing they are destroyed by their own carnal desires. And in this case, the carnal desire is the draw of addiction. You're not able to say no. And the other thing that struck me was, I refer to the coxswain of a ship, who is typically in the military, that would be an enlisted man who takes orders from a captain, but he's really running the ship and steering it. And if he makes a mistake, the entire crew is doomed. So if you're involved in that person's life, if you are entrenched in their life as a mother or a father or a sibling or a friend, you will be destroyed with him if you can't separate yourself from him. Mm. And that is the, I would say, in the top five most difficult and most painful things to do is to turn your back on somebody when they most need you. But there's a moment where you have the opportunity to abandon ship or go down with it. Mm. And so I just felt that was such a poignant expression, a metaphorical characterization of how addiction works and how deadly it is. And I also just want to take a moment to say, this is not an anti-drug message. In this arena, I don't like to talk about politics. It doesn't really matter how you feel about drugs. What matters is that a 14-year-old should never have access to them in an unfettered way. They're not capable of making decisions that are reasonable, and they can very quickly get swept up into this horrible, violent vortex that takes their soul. And if you have a child that is old enough, then you run the risk of losing your own soul or life yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I felt like that passage was so important to include.
Mm-hmm. Most certainly, because and I know that there are parents out there listening that have preteens and teens, and I don't know that you can monitor their lives enough, but then you still have to give them that freedom to grow into the adult that you want them to be, where they are, where they can make the right decision. So, and I know that that's got to be a very, very fine line to work with your teen. I know that we're not onto drug, you know, a drug campaign. I totally get that. But when you look back, Guy, is there something that you would say to parents, oh, keep your eye open for that?
Well, allow me an anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
I had a moment where I had a little bit of money and I built a very nice home in Cedar Park and life seemed grand. And all of a sudden I noticed I was finding lighters around in the children's play den and in my son's room. I was finding lighters and I was like, what? I really didn't understand what was going on. And I had a friend, a very good friend named Robert, and I was asking him about this and he said, dummy. And I was like, he is not. And it turns out that's exactly what he was doing, but he was also doing something else. He was also smoking pot. And what I didn't know was that one of his friends had his parents, that his friend's parents were small-time drug dealers because they use drugs recreationally, and this is how they subsidize their habit. But what that meant to him was that he had access to drugs. Now, what I would say is that when you see this sort of aberration, this behavior that doesn't make any sense to you, given your child's age and what you know about them, your gut is going to tell you. Your instinct will rear up and say, something isn't right here. I made the mistake of dismissing that. I would recommend you not do so. Mm-hmm. Don't follow my example. I don't know how I would have found this out, and I'm not even sure what I would have done in knowing this, because he was at that point 14 or 15 and was beginning to express his own independence, which I didn't want to neuter, you know?
Right.
So I understood that children eventually must rebel against their parents in order to establish themselves as an independent adult. I understood that that was important, but you're in a really difficult arena at that point. And what I would say is the most important thing is don't ignore your instinct. Don't ignore your instinct. It's right on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Guy, we're coming to the end of our time, and it goes by so quick.
Yes.
What would you want people to walk away with after they finish reading this book?
I would want people to walk away with a sense, please forgive the term, I think I've used it a couple of times, with a sense of commiseration. Most of us are going to deal with one of the big themes that is discussed in this book, that are discussed in this book, and that is the theme of addiction, the theme of incarceration, and the theme of losing a loved one. Now, you may not lose a child, but I was just talking with somebody that I gave my book to. I gave it away to this person, and 3 days later, she lost her best friend in a terrible automobile accident on Highway 71. And I wrote this book for that person, that now she can, when she was talking to me about how she felt when she got this news, and how she was dealing with the parent of this person who was lost. She was saying all the things that I wrote in this book about losing that someone. And she was expressing them for the first time. But when you read it in print and your thoughts are articulated, then there's a sense of comfort that you're not alone in this situation. That's what I want people to walk away
with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Most certainly. And there is some comfort in knowing that you're not alone in that. Like I said, that's one of the reasons that I created this radio show, is to help me, but to also let people know that they are not alone in this. Guy, we're getting ready to go into the final questions here, but would you give your contact information out one more time, just in case someone's listening and they would like a copy of your book, A Life That Mattered?
Yeah, I would say go to my blog spot, which is guyoliverspeaks.com, and if you're on Facebook, take a look at Guy Oliver Speaks, the fan page. You can do a simple Facebook search and find it there. And you're welcome to, send me a friend request on Facebook on my personal page as well. But those are the main two places that I recommend you go.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so we're down to the last three questions here. The first one is, what one thing has helped you the most when dealing with the loss of your son?
The thing that helped me the most was there were a handful of friends. Well, if I may.
Please.
I want to just offer what didn't help me, which when I hear people ask this question when they're in a crisis, they typically say, if they're a person of faith, God got me through this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person of faith, and in my case, my faith was a stumbling block to me. My faith in God, my belief, my utter assurance to myself that there is a God really was a stumbling block to me in the beginning, and I said some very unkind things about God and to God for what I was dealing with and the misery and the injustice that I felt. But what did get me through this was people. The most important thing to me at that time was that there were a handful of people who regularly checked in with me. My wife was there with me constantly. I mean, well, in the sense that we lived together. I had friends. There was one friend in particular. She was a friend of Mario's as well. Lacey, she would contact me and she would say things like, "It's a beautiful day, go out in the sunshine and get some vitamin D. Walk your dog. Make sure you have plenty of water." And these were not long conversations, and often they had nothing to do with my son or how I was feeling. And what I found there that you can do for somebody else is you don't have to know the right thing to say. All you have to do is let that person know that they're not alone in their grief.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the thing that really got me through. And, you know, I was just so appreciative of those people who would go out of their way just to say, "Hey, I'm thinking about you. You doing okay?" You don't have to say, you don't have to have great words of wisdom and say, "How can I help you today with what you're feeling right now?" It's not necessary. They'll ask.
And I'll tell you, Guy, the great thing is technology makes it easy for us to do that. There is no reason why you can't drop that that text that says "thinking about you." You don't have to feel that awkwardness in standing in front of someone or pick up the phone and have that period of silence, not knowing what to say. Just saying, texting, "thinking about you." Can't tell you how
thinking
helpful
about,
that works for me.
Yes. Thinking about you is huge, and it doesn't require anything of you.
Right, exactly. Well, that kind of leads into the next question a little bit. How can a friend or a family member help someone who's struggling with a loss? And I think we covered one of those, but are there other ways that maybe friends and family can support someone who is struggling with a loss?
Well, I think the key thing there, and it is related, but it's not exactly the same. The key there is availability. And by availability, I'm sorry, pardon me. By availability, I don't mean, continually trying to be with them, but just making yourself available if the person wants to talk or if the person wants, you know, just a moment of your time, scoping out moments where you say, you know, "Okay, I'm really busy right now, but, you know, Saturday I should really make myself available for a few minutes and see if, you know, Guy or Linda need to talk." The availability is the thing. It's not really the obligation to interact or do a particular thing.
Right, exactly. That's great advice, just to let them know, "Hey, I'm here. You know,
right.
I'm here.
Again, it's really big."
Right. Exactly. So we talked earlier also about how, you know, we're just not always equipped with how to handle a loss. And we're all going to experience it. It doesn't matter whether it's a loss of a job, a loss of a parent, a loss of a spouse. We're going to experience loss in life.
Right.
Is there anything that you could advise those or share with those out there so that we would be a little better equipped when we are faced with a loss?
Yeah, there is definitely one thing that I would advise. I mean, this is just me. you know, make your own decision for your own life. But something that I learned, fortunately, I was already in therapy when my when I got the news about my son's accident, and so I was fortunate to have somebody that I was talking to once a week in depth. And I was talking about the support of my friends and how, you know, as I mentioned earlier, how people would touch base with me and just check in. And the therapist stopped me and said, this moment. And she said, I see most of my clients are men your age. I was in my 55 at the time. And she said, most of them are divorced. Most of them do not have close ties with their children. Most of them don't have friends because they've invested all of their time in their career. And then they have a crisis and they come to me. And I'm all they have for $150 an hour, 1 hour a week. That's all they have. And she said, you have no idea right in this moment how fortunate you are to have the network of friends that you have. And it turns out, and this is where I believe in divine intervention, I met this group of friends of which Mario was a part. They were just so supportive during all of that time in the aftermath of my son's accident. And I began to get, I started getting to know these people about 9 months before, you know, he passed. And if I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't been for that network, that support network that I had through these people. And so I would say make the investment in people who will return your love and return your investment. Invest in their lives and, try to pick people who will invest in your life. And then when you have a crisis, a loss, especially an unexpected one, there will be people there for you. And those will be the people get you through, you know, the really difficult moments that are ahead.
You know, Guy, when we live our life day to day, we think we've got control of it. We think we got it all figured out. We're living the life. We're working the career. We're building the houses. And we think we've got it all. But it boils down to is those relationships, you know, and it's making sure that you surround yourself with people who care for you, but also be in that circle to care for others as well. So that's really critical. And as we get older, we realize that that's what it's all about. It's really not the careers. It's really not the titles. It's really not what kind of car you drive. It's more about the people that you have in your life and how you care for each other. And that's what it boils down to, just caring.
I think that is really the only thing that makes life worth living at all. That's just my opinion. What else in life is there, really, when you get right down to it? Is there really anything else that life is really about? In so many cultures, what family and friends look forward to is sitting down and eating a meal together. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important? It's important because we're nurturing each other and we're sharing nourishment of both a spiritual and a physical nature. And again, even if you're an atheist, that's not that's not different. You that's where you draw life from.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Guy, I tell you, it's been great having you on the show. And please feel free to reach out the next time you've got something else that you want the listeners to hear about. I'm here. I'd love to have you again. Enjoyed the interview. I love your honesty, your authenticity, and vulnerability, because what I was told is that many times people watch us, and as we go through this difficult situations like we've been through, losing a loved one, they watch, and when we come out on the other side, it gives them hope. It gives others
yes.
hope, because people do yes. watch. And, you know, folks, the lives that people post out on Facebook, that may not necessarily be the Shangri-La that they're actually living. So don't think that everybody is living the life, and you're not. You know, it's just not always posted out there. But, again, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I appreciate you writing the book, A Life That Matters, because every life does matter.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You know, folks, like Guy says, it is about just caring for each other. It is about, that's what life is about, is caring for each other. We're in this world together, whether you like it or not, folks. We're in the same ship. So it's about taking care of each other. I want to leave you with a quote. You know, I always leave you with a quote. Well, today's quote is actually the subtitle for Guy's book. We will all leave this world. Leave it better. So think on that. Chew on that a bit this week. And just remember, we will all leave this world. Leave it better. Thanks again for joining me on Loss and Starting Over. Look forward to hearing from you next week.
This has been an episode of Loss and Starting Over, a weekly show on the Tough Talk Radio Network. Remember that whatever you're going through, you don't have to go through it alone. We're here to help. Come back next week for another episode of Loss and Starting Over with Linda Ballesteros. Thank you for listening.